Hello, Mustang fans, and welcome to another Ford Performance Edition of the Mustang Owners Podcast. I'm John Clore, Enthusiast Communications Manager for Ford Performance, along with my co-host, Mike Ray, President of the Mustang Owners Club of Southeastern Michigan, or MOXM, and the International Council of Mustang Clubs. You know, Mike and I have long said that everyone has a Mustang story, so that's why we work to bring you the inside stories behind all the cool cars, clubs, collectors, and the characters in this incredible Mustang hobby that we enjoy so much. And Mike, speaking of enjoyment, tonight we've got a very special episode that features one of our true Mustang heroes of all time.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, it seems like we were just celebrating 50 years yesterday, and now here we are at the 60 years. It's crazy.
Yeah, well, somebody better, is this something to do with daylight savings time?
Yeah, it's absolutely nuts. I mean, that 10 years really flew by. And our special guest tonight is one who has a major role in that 60-year history, and we're so happy to have him.
So that's right, ladies and gentlemen, tonight here on the Mustang Owners Podcast, please welcome somebody you should always have in your head and mind when you think about the Mustang. He was the chief engineer on our beloved SN95 fourth generation Mustang, and again on the S197 fifth generation Mustang, and many other projects that he touched along his career at Ford. We're talking to Art Hyde. Art, welcome to the Mustang Owners Podcast.
Well, thank you very much, and nice to talk to you and Mike.
Well, you know that we always take you aside. We see you around a lot. And, you know, Art, whether it was when you were working at Ford, you were still always sneaking out the side door, looking at Mustang, talking to owners. And, you know, I like to tell people that, you know, I just passed my 180th column, I think, for Mustang Times. And you were writing columns for Mustang Times as an engineer, not as a marketing guy right. or a communications guy. Yeah. You were doing all these Lord's work with the clubs long before marketing even got a hold of it. And that's why I think, I'm not sure, Mike, you can back me up on this. When you're that tight with the Mustang community and you're the chief engineer, Art, that had to absolutely help you when it came to guidance on taking this product through Ford.
Oh, absolutely. Now, but I think the hard part is not getting it through Ford, because frankly, in general, there was a lot of support in Ford for Mustang. But the... is to figure out where to take the vehicle, because they hand it to you, which then you have to say, okay, now what?
Yeah.
You can't just do the same old thing the same old way.
No, each series, and you doing two generations kind of sets you apart. And you might say, well, it was the time of your life when you were at that point and they had trust in you from the first one. But both of those cars, the SN95 and the S197, were so totally different and so created in much different times. One, I think the SN95 was a way to try to save this product, and the S197 was a way to reincarnate it. Those were so different, Art. Could you tell us a little bit about that background on how these cars, even though, yeah, they're both Mustangs, and they both were successful in their own right, but man, they were so different products.
Well, in a lot of ways, they were creatures of the times, right? Yeah. So, you know, we had the Fox body that came out in 79 based on the 78 Fairmont. And we had been riding that horse, so to speak, ever since 79. And there really weren't any changes to it. If you think about 79 to 93, there were no changes in that car, really, from an engineering perspective. Okay, we threw the HO engine in it. We put some front and rear end and a new instrument panel. But nothing that was substantial.
Yeah.
You know, 90% of the car was exactly the same as it was in 79. And at that time, frankly, the economy wasn't so great. And, it was really a challenge. I mean, the Mustang, frankly, was losing a lot of money. So there wasn't a lot of support for it. And, you know, thank our mutual friend, one of my heroes is John Colletti, who had the chutzpah to really, I'll call it, take on the powers that be, who would just be happy to let the Mustang fade in the distance, And because of, you know, the political unpopularity of it at that point. But he didn't do that. And he got the team set up, the whole Skunk Works team down at Danau. And we, you know, they did a great job. I was fortunate that I became a member of that team and as in the body engineering role. And it was a great team. And they reinvented the car substantially. And they could only do it with substantial amounts of executive overhead, you know, because I think it was Ken Dabrowski was one of them who just fought a lot of battles for us. Because there's a lot of people who just wanted to kill it because we're losing too much money.
You know, Art, I remember those times well. And when I started at SVT working under Coletti in 1995, mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I'm inside Ford now. I'm going to start talking to people about that whole chance of this thing going south, the car being put out to pasture, and then we building a Mazda Japanese front-wheel drive, Japanese devised and built car out of Flat Rock when it was. And I could not for the life of me, Art, figure out who at the vice president or above level was the one that just was the straw that broke the camel's back. And, you know, I know Bill Ford, you know, was whatever the team wanted, and it wasn't anybody I could pinpoint. And I know you were.
You mean who?
Yeah, who was the guy?
Because, yeah. Who did Coletti appeal to?
You know, I know Coletti, you know, got the green light to go do something else, but it wasn't until I talked to Neil Ressler when he told me that when Bob Rui walked through the review on it, was it the SN16 or the SN16 they called it, or
ST16.
Oh,
so yeah. I actually was in Japan and supporting that program.
Yes. And there was he saw there was a pony.
Did I say that? How about that? Yeah, I'm not sure.
That's okay, Art. We still love you. But he saw there was a pony on that, and they were telling him that was going to be the Mustang.
Yeah.
He told me at Mike Ray's 50th party there that when he walked through and he said, that's a nice little car, but it's not a Mustang. Call it something else. And he told Bill Ford that he can't sell that as a Mustang to his 4,000 Ford dealers. So he was really against it. And that's a VP telling his number one marketing guy telling, hey, this, it's just not going to work. And I think that kind of fueled however John got support.
Well, no, I think that you hit the nail on the head, actually. You picked the right people. Neil Ressler and Rui, Bob Rui, were the two people that were that air cover for him at that stage. And then when it got to the point where they had, I'll call it, imposed themselves on everybody else, that we would set up this team and it was an impossibly low investment that they gave the team, an impossibly high profit target. So the team had a heck of a big struggle. And Coletti substantially is the one who put together the business case on how to do it and then built the team and then they named Will Boddy. Once they named Will Boddy as the chief, that really helped things. And then we got Ken Dabrowski to also run air cover. So we had pretty strong support, but it was strong support on a short leash, if you think about it, because it was they didn't give us much money to play with.
Well, Mike, how does this sound when we were talking to Gail Halderman and when you speak to Sperlich, the original team was given very little money? Yeah. I mean, and an impossible, remember, they said it was like ridiculously low amounts of money, which was why they went to Falcon, and a ridiculous time frame with the excuse that every Ford and 65's already been redesigned, there's no money left. So that kind of sets you up to fail, Art, that you don't have any money, they don't have any time, so there's no way you can pull it off.
But John, right. Doesn't that justify them being the heroes as we deem them?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yes,
but particularly, I have to say Coletti, because the number of battles that he fought was a big number. I mean, I had to fight a lot of battles too.
You guys don't win popularity.
But that was a little late, my battles were 4 or 5 years after Coletti's big battles.
Oh,
geez. But you know, the I used to call them the antibodies. We're always trying to catch the Mustang virus out and get it out of the system.
Oh God.
Yeah.
Well, Art Hyde, thank God you were and John were successful because I mean, to me, right now, Mike, you can back me up on this. The SN95 is the entry product for most young people
Yeah.
in the hobby with that. And what is it, Mike? The American Muscle Catalog?
Yeah, I mean, Fox Body, you had that title for a long, long time, but now it's moved on to the SN95s, and the Fox Bodies are going through the moon.
Well, yeah, but I mean, the kids, I mean, you can still find decent SN95s.
Yeah, that's the 95s is it now. Yeah, that's your starter. That's your getting into the hobby. Yeah, for sure.
Well, but I still have an SN95.
Yeah, we
Oh,
know.
I think I like the SN95. I think it's lighter than the present car. It's a good car.
Yeah, it and you there's parts for it. You can
Yeah,
work on it.
anything.
You
Yeah.
can Yeah, I mean, it's a great entry level for and the young people getting in the hobby. It's a great looking little car,
We're celebrating them this year, John.
That's right, it's
We're
the
doing a
anniversary.
30-year reunion of the SN95 this year.
Oh God. Well, Art, we wanted to talk to you a little bit about that because with 60 years coming up, I'm sure when you were, you finally got approval. And I remember going to the long lead for the fourth gen out in Solvang. And I don't know if it was Will Boddy or Mike Zevelkink who did the you guys flip the chassis and you painted all the parts
Yeah,
that were
right.
Fox body and all the ones that were what do they call it? Fox 4.
Yeah, Fox 4, right.
And so and I was at Auto Week at the time and I was asking him all these questions about so this was the Fox body and this was and then I said, well, how come weren't you guys supposed to come up with a mod motor in this thing and now we still have the 302? And he goes, one
Well,
question, he goes, one question at a time.
there was a reason why we staggered it.
Do you want to share that?
Oh yeah. Well, the reason is, well, frankly, the overhead valve engine had a big following, and was much lower cost and weight.
Yeah.
So from I told you, I mentioned that they had low investment, and they had low piece cost target, and that was true for the 94 program. But in 96, we got the extra money, and we were able to put the modular in. But the at first we didn't have it.
Oh yeah, and that now makes sense when you think about it because it's if you got a cost target, you got to make it or the car doesn't happen.
Right. And the I think actually if you let it up to Coletti, and I liked his laser focus on what did we really need the modular motor? And we decided the answer was really it's a nice to have, it's not a gotta have. The only reason it might be a gotta have is if that's the only way you can make pass emissions. And they've been able, I mean, at the time everybody was saying the small block Chevy wouldn't be around.
That's right.
Okay, that is older than all of us.
Is, yeah. And the
Ed
Windsor's been
Cole, you
around.
got to hand it to Ed Cole. That was a hell of an
That
invention.
was a yeah. And the but the Windsor's been around a while too. And the other thing I talk about is that, there was a, with the club side on Mike's side of the world. There was pushback because they all had 302s. They were all rolling in
Yeah.
their 50s. They had a catalog full of parts. They didn't want to throw all that out and start over with some motor they didn't even understand.
Well, that's where Coletti was coming from.
Oh, okay. Well,
So
see.
no, but as I recall, I think it was Mike Evans was really the one pushing within the team, the one who really wanted to do the modular stuff, if I recall correctly. But so it was controversial even within the team. But I stand that that was the right decision. We wouldn't have had been able to afford the vehicle because too much repackaging had to be done. And we never would have hit the investment target. No
Well, I
chance.
know later on when you we've so many times come to see you speak and talk about your times with that car. And Mike Ray always likes to tell me that, you give credit to Mr. Coletti for the SN95, but during its as it got older, your role in bringing the Mach 1 and the Bullitt to life to bring those vehicles to market and re-inject some financial shot in the arm to that car.
Well, and also customer satisfaction, John.
Yeah, oh, that's right. Well,
I
that's
mean,
because you're tied to the
you think
clubs.
about it. So we hit that we the new edge is it was has become known by, was issued. And it was right on top of a Camaro freshening, if you might recall.
Right.
And when we showed it to people, they just said, oh, okay, it's just another, there's nothing really to it. But we came up with some pretty clever packaging. Remember the aluminum wheels and stereo system?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
And in the end, we actually put a nail in Camaro's coffin with that. But, you know, the Mustang itself, really, this owner satisfaction at the time, even though we did a number to the Camaro, we didn't want Camaro to die, but our customer satisfaction was only 65%.
Wow.
And the doing the Mach 1 and the Bullet wasn't just about the finances. It was also about we could get better finances and improve customer satisfaction. And we did that. And it was 10 points higher for customer satisfaction. And I think the Bullet made more money with that limited run of 5,500 vehicles than the rest of the car line did.
Oh, wow. Well,
that Mike, in 2001.
Mike, you were right. You said that, you know, when they stayed close and kind of fished some of these ideas through the clubs, that the feedback on, boy, what Mach 1 would be cool. And boy, nobody even dreamed of the Bullet. And Mike, you kept saying, you know, well, there was a lot of input you were getting from the clubs. And I think that was Art's, that was his ace in the hole, that he always knew what people were thinking. And I don't know how you fish Bullet out of there wasn't a Bullet to
the call. The Bullet came from do you remember Sean Tant, the designer?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So Sean Tant did the wheel, Castro, what do we call it? The wheel that we ended up using on the Bullet vehicle. And we sold it as an option in 2000. And sort of a throwback design, it was just like the movie car wheel, yep. But yep. Updated. And Sean and I were literally shooting this shit in my office, and I said, you know, let's just do the rest of the car. How about let's just do the rest of the car? You did the wheel. Let's do the rest of the car. And we knew we were going to be heavily constrained, and we thought about the idea of sending it to a show car. Now, I did not have the authority to program a show car, but I did have the authority to dip into my engineering budget and fund the development, which I did. But Sean, remember, locked himself away at Roush and created the show car that we sent to LA, and it was a massive hit. It was a bigger hit than we ever dreamed.
I'll be darned.
And also, John, with this, talking about both of those cars, Mach 1 is 55-year anniversary this year that we're celebrating.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, with Mach 1, those guys, I mean, they had a battle for the shaker, and they got the wheel that looked a lot like the Magnums.
Yeah. But
with Bullet, they had a movie. It was a deep-chromed Steve McQueen, like, to take all the badging on.
Yeah.
That's not really a car. That was just I mean, you guys had to really pull that off your hat. You just...
Well, the thing was that we decided we didn't want to do a trim package. So, I mean, it had suspension, it had brakes, it had a better engine. That was a complete car, different axle ratio. It was a complete car.
So this
but
now...
we sold it, but we couldn't get buy-in from Ford Division.
Oh, brother.
So we sold it as an option on the GT. It was really funny because, you know, Jim O'Connor, who was the head of Ford Division at that point, was absolutely in bed with us, but he wouldn't order his team to fall in line. And Steve Lyons, who was O'Connor was general manager of marketing, excuse me.
Right, that's right.
And Steve Lyons was head of Ford, and he wouldn't just order Steve to do it. But Steve never bought in. Just never bought in, and he just resisted us every step of the way. And mainly because we were, you know, when he, and I had this discussion with Steve once, and he replayed it to me about 4 or 5 years ago, that I said, the difference here is, Steve, you think, and Ford Division thinks the customer is the dealers.
Yeah.
But we think the one who's the customer that we have to be focused on is the one who buys the vehicle and injects their revenue, the cash, into the organization.
What a concept.
Yeah, but it may sound stupid or, you know, obvious, but, you know, let's face it, all their performance reviews were based on the dealers.
Yep.
Everything was based on the dealers because they were totally dependent on the dealers moving the metal. And and you go and you ask the dealers, what do they want? You know, I have friends who are dealers and they told me the same thing. We want something that's good looking, has great colors that will attract attention if it's parked on my lot, and it's cheap. That's what they wanted. That's not what the Mustang community wanted.
So this art, I'm going to explain it to you because a lot of people don't tell you this. But we've been watching your career from the other side of the world. And we have met so many engineers who thought they were marketing guys. But you're scary good at this marketing thing. So I don't want to blow any smoke right now. But I got to tell you, when you start thinking in the way that Mike Ray would think in the club world, and you're on the engineering side, that doesn't usually happen. Because, and Mike, I used to say, we talked to some engineers, they'd walk away. I go, well, don't listen to that guy. He's got a pocket protector. Didn't I say that?
Yeah, and I absolutely agree. I mean, with that, you said most of the engineers are in one area and the marketing team is in the other. But I think Art, as an engineer, made the biggest marketing move in the enthusiast Mustang world ever with Mustang Alley, right?
Oh, well, yeah, that's another one. Yeah.
So, I mean, tell us about that, Art. Like, I mean, tell them you are the creator of Mustang Alley, but that's an engineer and you think that would come from the marketing team. Yeah. But no, it came from you.
Yeah, no, I didn't know it didn't come from the marketing team. Yeah. but you understand why we created Mustang Alley, right?
Absolutely. For the enthusiast, right? I mean, that's
sort of, yes. So here, this is my thinking. Part of the problem was even our engineers working on Mustang, who've drove a lot of Mustangs, a lot of them did not own Mustangs. And other than a lease car, and that doesn't count. You know, a corporate lease car. In my opinion, that doesn't count. So they really didn't know the psyche of the real Mustang enthusiasts. And John, I can't remember if you were with us yet, but I know Austin Craig was heavily involved with this. We did the immersion excursions.
Absolutely. I remember that was my first year.
And what that said was what people want is they want an experience. We were selling a lifestyle. We weren't selling a product.
Right.
And the issue was that the company did not understand that. Mm-hmm. And so when we started thinking about this lifestyle, that's why I said, hey, let's make the rest of the car. Because that's, don't you think Steve McQueen engenders a lifestyle vision?
Oh, yeah. That's the whole persona.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we had people that weren't alive when he was making movies. When you ask them, who are you when you drive the vehicle? And we'd show them some pictures and they would pick out this guy with the corduroy jacket on.
Yeah.
Even women.
Wow. Wow.
And so, you know, they didn't know who he was, but they liked that. That was the look. You know, for women, it was the don't mess with me.
Right.
You know, because Mustang's always been around, you know, self-actualization, self-expression, you know, you know, essentially independence, American values, freedom.
Well, so you were trying to immerse, not only that, you're trying to immerse your engineering team in the lifestyle that is the enthusiast by sticking Mustang Alley in the middle of this gigantic insanity that we call Woodward Dream.
Well, what it was, as I saw an opportunity, there was already a lot of Mustangs around. And so I was there with my wife and my kids, and we were walking around Ferndale because that's where the Woodward Dream Cruise started.
Right.
And we were walking around, and there were a lot of Mustangs there. And I'm thinking, well, hell, you know, we're, you know, 15 minutes, 20 minutes from World Headquarters and the Ford campus. Why don't we just, let's make a party out of this. And at that time, I think, who was I? I had an engineer. I'm picturing him. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, which is horrible. Who was getting divorced, and his divorce attorney was the mayor of Ferndale.
Great.
And it turned out the mayor of Ferndale owned a Mustang, was into Mustangs. And so I said, can you ask, see if we can next year, if we, I'd like to do a Mustang Alley thing. And I want to start it at Ford and drive. We're going to do a big convoy and we're going to wind up on 9 Mile. And I think the first year we had, 25 cars or maybe 30 cars. I don't know, wow. Mike, you remember?
No, I don't. I don't think it was that low. Wow.
I know the first year.
It wasn't very much. It wasn't
You didn't fill that first block.
Right. No, it wasn't very much.
Nope.
But I spent a lot of time in the dunk tank, I'll have you know. and the, but in the second year, it started catching on.
Yeah.
And then the third year, we did the drag races out of World Headquarters.
Oh, yeah.
Very popular. And I don't want to go any farther with that particular thing.
No.
It was very popular. And we went to Woodward. But this way, not only could I get the Ford engineers to sort of see how much fun it was as a community. Because, you know, they would go and they'd actually take test cars and stuff if they didn't have one. But they would come down and they actually, you know, I had them working at the Dream Cruise because that way they would talk to people.
Right.
Right. And
that's genius.
And I thought it was a really good way because they really didn't understand. And I couldn't take all of them on immersion excursions. Now, the other thing I was doing, John, further to something you mentioned before, was I had people like Doug Sparks and the other PMT leaders writing columns also and in different sites. I was doing Mustang Times and I did one in the Corral.
Right.
But there were other people that were doing them in different places, like I can't remember all, but there was a Muscle Mustang related website that Doug was doing. I remember Doug's was very popular. Hmm.
You know, that is such an advantage because we learned early on, Coletti wanted me to keep my foot in that journalism world with SVT and the other side because it gave you a little more, hey, we're one of you too. We're not just shills and marketing types. We're enthusiasts. And you guys doing that set the whole stage. And now Mike and I, you know, once you said it started getting popular, I know it got popular when all of a sudden Mike Ray found out about it and got Moxham involved. And 800 people.
Well, actually, as I recall, Mike, and correct me if I don't have this right, I think you already had a setup that was just up the street.
We
had trouble convincing you to join with us.
No, that's not true. We were on there. We just needed more space. So,
oh, that's right. You needed more space, and we couldn't guarantee it. That's right.
Right. Yeah. That's
right.
It.
Right. Right.
But, you know, I got a major question for you. Art, talking about Woodward Mustang Alley and all that. I want to know the story behind the Woodward Dream Cruise Edition Mustang. That's the 95.
Oh, yeah. Oh, gosh. That was a local dealer who...
Yeah, the Detroit Area Dealers Association.
Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah.
Yeah.
They wanted something.
Did you come up with that?
No, I did not come up with that.
No? Okay.
No.
That was a marketing thing, Mikey.
Okay.
Went through
Think of it like, remember in the past we did things like the Twister?
Yeah.
And the California Special.
Yeah.
Those were done by the regions.
Right.
Okay.
Not by Ford.
Okay.
Yeah, and I got to drive one, Mike, because nobody wanted to drive one with a clutch on the Woodward Dream Cruise because their left kneecap blew off about 2 hours later.
I really like those cars a lot. I think they're really, really cool.
They are really cool.
Before we have you come back and talk about S197, and before we close tonight, we'd like to ask you, now that Mustang turned 60, A, did you think it was going to go to 60, and B, you know, what has it meant to you personally to be involved with this?
Oh, my God. Well, John, you know the story from the 64 World's Fair.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, Mustang was... my entire focus from the when I saw it at the 64 World's Fair, and so it means a lot. I have to say there were a lot of times that I didn't think Mustang would be around this long. I have to say, but it's great. I mean, I'm glad to see it evolve, and you know, frankly, while it may be controversial, one thing that we can take some pride in is that the company feels is basically using it to establish their innovation image with a Mach-E. They may or may not love a four-door SUV Mustang, but the company understands the value of the brand. And they did not understand that, I have to say, at the time that I was running it. Not all of it. They took it for granted rather than understood the power of the brand.
Well, thanks to people like you, Art, and all of the efforts of you and the teams that you've worked on all those years, we're celebrating 60. We're going to have you back for the second half of our podcast with Art Hyde and talk about S197 and how that got us to where we are today. Art, thank you so much for spending your time. I know Mike's got a million other questions that I pushed off the side, and Mike, we'll get them back.
I'll answer all of them, Mike. I'll answer every single one.
Thank you again, Art, for joining us tonight. We really appreciate your time. We'll have you back shortly.
Thank you.
Well, that's a wrap for this edition of the Mustang Owners Podcast, but don't forget to check out the enthusiast section of FordPerformance.com this week. And if you haven't already done so, get your Mustang Club or Facebook group registered on FordPerformanceClubConnect.com. There's my little commercial. And all of your Mustangs registered on FordSpecialVehicleRegistry.com. So you can also find out what Mike's Mega Club is up to by visiting Moxum.com. And please make sure you're following the Mustang Owners Podcast on Spotify so you can be notified every time a new episode is uploaded. And as always, we welcome your comments and suggestions that you email to us at clubhub@ford.com. So until next time, we'll be looking to catch you down the road.